Today. Thank you. So, answer the last one. Congratulations. Okay, so let's have the last talk of the day. So, Matt, we have the pleasure to have Nathanael Bereschi from Vienna, and then we'll talk about the near-critical linear model, mass spectrometry and mass field theory.
All right, thank you very much. Hi, everyone. Can you all hear me well? Okay, very nice. I would like to start by thanking the organizers for their invitation. It is truly a pleasure to be here in front of such an impressive audience. I'll try to tell you some results. I think the title I was asked to present was Massive SLE, and then I negotiated it so that it would also include massive field theory, and didn't tell the organizers that actually what I will talk about is near-critical linear model. So I apologize in advance. Okay, so I try to start with some sort of generic overview. Talking a bit about criticality, conformal invariance, and of criticality. So I have in mind some lattice model of statistical mechanics, maybe easing. As is well known, when we look at the critical point, so you know there is a parameter that we tune, let's say the temperature or inverse temperature, and when we look at the critical point, what we see is the emergence of these conformal symmetries. As is well known from this paper by Polyakov-Samoylochikov, which really gave rise to this field of conformal field theory, I guess. And as is well known, when we look away from the critical point, we typically see exponential decay of correlations, and this leads to basically trivial scaling limits. So the kind of topic today is what happens when we look not exactly at the critical point, but not really far away from it. So pretty close to the critical point. So you can think that you know this temperature, you don't take it exactly equal to the critical value. You take it close to it in a way that depends on the mesh size where your model is living. And when you do that, what you see is that you obtain scaling limits that are non-trivial. And when you look at the scaling limits on infinitesimally small scales, you see that they behave just like their critical cousins, so conformally. But when you look at them on you know, large scales, then you do observe this exponential decay of correlations. So they are sort of a way of interpolating between these conformal field theories, conformal invariant scaling limits, and the ones that are trivial and have exponential decay of correlations, which you get when you take the parameter to be different from the critical value. So for these kind of near-critical scaling limits, you will have in general no conformal invariance, and this should lead to connections with sort of generic quantum field theories. Now, you know, these lattice models of statistical mechanics, often you can view them in sort of two different ways. It's a question of choice how you choose to view them. Either you can view them geometrically because you're thinking that there is a random curve that describes interfaces, or you can think of it as a random field. As a height function maybe, or something like this. And depending on how you choose to think about this model, you know, these two points of view, they lead to sort of fairly different descriptions of these models. And I'll try to examine both of these points of views here. So my own interest in this topic, I think, started when I read the paper of Makarov and Smirnov. which I think is very inspirational. And there is this paragraph here in this paper that I like very much. And I will read it here. It says, the key property of SLE is its conformal invariance, which is expected in 2D lattice models only at criticality. And the question naturally arises, can SLE success be replicated for off-critical models? In most off-critical cases, to obtain a non-trivial scaling limit, one has to adjust some parameter, sending it at an appropriate fit to the critical value, and such limits lead to massive field theories. So this paper is, you know, has lots of, I think still today, many interesting questions, and I encourage people to, it's quite short, I encourage people to look at it. Right, so so let me start with a geometric perspective, perhaps. So Makarov and Smirnov, they developed a family of examples, which they call the massive SLE. I should say that for the most part, there's no really general theory of these massive SLEs, at least as far as I'm aware. So they sort of really developed a number of examples, and they gave partial arguments for convergence of some interface of natural discrete models with these massive SLEs. Now, you know, for the other perspective, the field theoretic perspective, I try to give some evidence that one should observe in the limit some interesting model, which is called the Sand-Gordon model. And one thing that's remarkable about this Sand-Gordon model is that it's a quantum field theory, which is not conformal, but it is still integrable. There are still many things you can compute exactly. So I'll try to illustrate these two ideas, these two perspectives, with some recent results on, in particular, the near-critical dimer model. Okay. So really, the idea would be that when we're going to be considering this dimer model near its critical point, we'll be able to observe a connection both to massive SL2 and to this Sand-Gordon model. And the appearance of this Sand-Gordon model, I learned recently, was predicted at least by Lukyanov in 1997 in the context of the six vertex model. Probably it's the same thing as what I'm talking about here. I didn't check very carefully. And it may well be that there's even some older references that I'm not aware of. And so these results, they are joint works respectively with Levi-Hantzsch-Sivits for the connection to massive SLE2 and for Scott Mason and Lucaré for the connection to Sand-Gordon. But first, let me give you a bit an overview. I'll start with some review. What is in particular massive loop raised monomorph and massive SLE? This is perhaps the case where it's maybe easiest to understand what are those massive SLE. Then a very brief review of some examples, and then I talk a bit about the dimer model, in particular the Tempelian setup, and some review of earlier results at criticality, and then I describe some of these results, talking about the near critical model, some informal statement of results. It's, you know, there's kind of too much to talk about in 1 hour, so I think I'll try to focus more on the Sand-Gordon model than on massive SLE. So I'll try to give some review about this because it's a really non-trivial object to define, and it's a very interesting model in my opinion. And in particular on the Coleman transform, which is something that that is very relevant and important for how we prove things. And if there's time, I'll talk a bit about notions of massive holomorphicity, which play a role. And please feel free to interrupt to ask other questions. So let's start with some background. I'll talk about the massive loop raised monomorph, which was discussed in this paper of Makarov and Smirnov, but also it turns out a bit earlier in a paper of Bauer, Bernard, and Titola. And so here I have in mind that we are considering a random walk. So I call saying epsilon, so n is the time, you know, the number of steps of the walk. Epsilon denotes the lattice mesh size. And we have a domain omega, and omega epsilon is a discretization of this domain. And the walk starts from some interior point z0 and is killed when it leaves the domain omega. And then, as I think everyone knows, as the mesh size not delta, but epsilon tends to zero, if you speed up this random walk appropriately, I don't care how, but of course we know how, than speeding up this random walk, and then this converges to Brownian motion. Now, I'm interested in the loop erasure, meaning the process that you obtain as you erase the loop chronologically as you make them. And when you do that, you obtain a simple curve, random simple curve, and really one of the landmark results in SLE theory is this fantastic work of Laura Schramm and Werner from 2002, which shows that as the mesh size tends to zero, the loop erasure of this random walk, so this phrase random walk, converges to a certain random simple curve, which is called radial SLE. Okay. So far, so good. Now, what I'm interested in is considering an off-critical perturbation. So to do that, I'm going to fix a number m in R. And this number, I think of it as the mass. And what we are doing is, so I'm going to have this process x m epsilon, m because there's a mass in this problem. And now at each step, I suppose that the walk can be killed. And it's killed with a probability which is small, which is just m squared epsilon squared over 2. So, you know, this probability tends to zero. It's at each step, you've barely noticed a difference with the critical model. So it tends to zero, which is the critical value for this model at an appropriate speed, just like Makarov and Simonov said in their description. And so it's killed with this probability. And if it's not killed, it just continues on to a randomly chosen neighbor. So far it's just a walk, but I'm going to loop erase it in a second. So is it clear? I just, you know, toss a coin before moving with some probability I get killed, and with some other probability I continue, and if I continue, I just follow on at random. It's one of my four possible values. Okay, and what I'm going to do is I'm going to condition this walk to leave the domain omega without being killed. And you know, this has the effect of making the path a bit shorter, I guess, right? So it doesn't want to hang around too much, because if it hangs around too much, it risks being killed. So that modifies on a global scale the law of the process. And then we may ask, what is the scaling limit of the loop erasure of this process? So this is a question that was asked specifically in the paper of Makarov and Smirnov. So you have here a simulation. I don't know how well you can see these pictures. I can see them. Can you see them in the back? Oh, good. You can see these two pictures. It's a bit like a before and after, you know, type of picture that you see when you see the ads in the subway. So this is an ordinary loop erasure on the walk, and this is the after picture when you apply this massive procedure. And you can see that, you know, this tends. Well, on this picture, at least, we get a slightly straighter path, probably illustrating the fact that the walk itself is a bit shorter. Right. So the theorem, which was stated but not really proved in the paper of Makarov and Smirnov, and I think also discussed implicitly, at least in the work of Bauer, Bernard, and Tipola, but really the details were given in very nice paper of Chalkak and Wang, shows that as epsilon tends to zero, the loop erasure of this massive walk conditioned to exit the domain without being killed converges to a certain limit, which is this massive SLE2 as the mesh size epsilon tends to zero. And this is you know, a random curve. It's absolutely continuous with respect to ordinary SLE2. And this kind of absolute continuity is in general expected for a massive scaling limits corresponding to SLE kappa, whenever the parameter kappa is less or equal to 4. So the way this works, this massive SLE kappa, if one reads between the line, I think their definition in Makarov and Smirnov is the following. If I pick the kappa, then I can associate to SLE kappa a certain martingale observable. So something which will be a martingale as a function of time when I reveal more and more of the curve. And this martingale observable you know, has the following form. It's a power ZT to the beta times Z prime to the sigma, where beta is a free parameter and sigma is related to beta with a certain relation. And Z here, Z is just the central Bluffner flow. I don't want to get too much into the details of SLE because it will take us too much time. So we get a certain martingale, that's the point. And there's a natural way to associate to each such martingale observable a certain massive analog. It goes using this notion of resolvent equation for those who know. And by definition, we would say that the curve is a massive SLE if this massive observable indeed is a martingale.
Interesting. Couldn't this also be done by just the appropriate Brownian loop soup triterm directly in the continuum?
Okay, there's a question from Greg asking, could this be done directly using the Brownian loop soup? And probably, I'm guessing there's a possibility to do that. I'm not completely sure. I think, you know, it's not clear to me whether this definition is the best definition. But at least it's what you find in the paper of Langhoff and Stanhoff. As I said, you know, there's no real theory about this. For instance, I'm not sure the existence of a curve satisfying this property is known in general. So yes, maybe if there's a way to do it with Brownian loops, it probably would be quite interesting. I don't know. Can one write an exact lattice function for this? I didn't catch that.
I made the statement that you can write an exact lattice action.
So the question is, can one write an exact lattice action for the mass of the case? It's a statement. And the answer is yes. Sorry, yes.
There's a question.
There's another question. Okay.
Yeah, you have current theta. How does that relate to the mass?
So what happens is so often these martingale observable. So in principle, if I fix SLE kappa for every beta, this M is a martingale. But often what happens is that there is one natural choice of beta, because you can prove for this value of beta, there is an analog discrete martingale. Basically, that's it. But for every choice of beta, you have a martingale observable, and this martingale observable characterizes the load of SLE. And then the load does not depend on beta, it's always a load of SLE. Makes sense? So that's a bit the story for this massive SLE. So just very briefly, some examples. It's known that the harmonic explorer converges to a massive SLE4. This was kind of sketched in this paper of Makarov and Skarnov, and the details were given by Léonie Papon fairly recently. It's also known that the level lines of the massive Gaussian free field are the same massive SLE4. And they also coincide with a massive Brownian loop soup cluster outer boundary. This is also a result of Léonie. One can also consider a magnetically perturbed Ising model. And Léonie recently proved that the corresponding interfaces, they converge to a curve which is absolutely continuous with respect to SLE3. And I guess one can think it's a form of massive SLE3, but she did not prove that it coincides with the definition of Magdorf and Smirnov as I gave it a moment ago. Right. So that's a very short review of what
that is. Better to perturb to being temperature or real magnetic field?
Yes, magnetic field, exactly. So that's what I meant by that. The question was, did I mean magnetic field or temperature perturbation? You could do both for the Ising model. But this result is about magnetic perturbation. You add a small magnet. Okay, so I want to move to the diamond model, because this is where I'll be able to say some novel results. And the diamond model is a very nice model of statistical mechanics. Very briefly, it's you have a planar graph, and you consider perfect matchings on this graph. By which I mean a subset of edges which cover every vertex exactly. It's well known that I can reformulate, well, I shouldn't point because different people cannot see. So it's well known that we can reformulate the dimer configuration as a tiling of the associated region of the plane. So what we do is we imagine that every vertex is at the center of a face. And when I have a dimer edge, I just glue the two adjacent faces together. And that forms, in this case, a rhombus, a general gluing of two faces. And that tiles the associated region of the plane. And it's a model that is very well known, particularly because it has a rich behavior. It has a phase diagram with multiple faces. It can be either in the liquid, the gas, or solid phases. And this corresponds to the beautiful work of Kenyon Okungov and Sheffi. So I'm going to talk just about what is happening on the square lattice. And I want to give you a bit of to spend a bit of time talking about the combinatorial details of the dimer model, because unlike other models of statistical mechanics, the dimer model is extremely sensitive to the exact microscopic detail, the boundary conditions, and things like that. So what is the Tempelian domain? I'll start by saying that we're gonna color every vertex of the square lattice black and white in the usual checkboard pattern. But in the case of the dimer model, it actually pays off to subdivide further the black vertices into two classes. So, you know, the black vertices of the square lattice are themselves a copy of the square lattice. And I'm going to subdivide those into two in the checkboard pattern, just as I did with the original lattice. So really, I have two types of black vertices, which I've helpfully decided to color blue and red. And so the ones that are not colored, and which are actually black on the picture, but you should ignore that, they are what I think of as white vertices. Okay, so we have the black vertices, which are important, and then this can be blue or red, and we have the rest of the vertices, which are white. Okay, and then the Tempelian domain, Tempelian boundary condition, is saying that as we navigate along the boundary, only black vertices of one given type, let's say the blue type, are exposed. Okay, so you can see that on this domain, as I go along the boundary, I only see blue vertices. And I have, if I just do that, it turns out this will not be tileable, this domain. There will not be dimer configuration associated with that. And I have to remove the corner, and I pick one corner and I just remove it. So here I've chosen to remove the top right corner. But you see that if I hadn't done that, if I hadn't removed this corner, then every black vertex on the boundary would be blue. Is that clear? So that's what I call a Tempelian domain. And it turns out this boundary condition might look a bit funny, but I guarantee you this is really the most canonical boundary condition one can put on the dimer model. It's canonical from many different perspectives, and this is one where we can really say a lot of things about the dimer. Right, so I've told you what was the dimer configuration, but I haven't really specified the law on dimer configuration. And here we're going to imagine that our graph comes with weight, and the dimer model is that we pick dimer configuration with the probability proportional to the product of the edge weight in the configuration. And then you normalize it with a factor one of the z, just so that it's probability measured. And there is this when you know all the weights are chosen to be equal to one, so that would be the critical case. Then there is this really landmark result of Rick Kenyon, who proved that the dimer model is asymptotically conformal invariant. I think this was the first proof of conformal invariance probability. You know, much more than that, also the introduction of the method discrete polymorphicity, so really a landmark paper. And what he proved really specifically is that there is an associated height function, which maybe I don't really define because it will take me too much time, but there is an associated height function which is associated to the dimer model. And his result really says that as the mesh size tends to zero, when we consider that dimer model on Tempelian approximation of a given domain, then the height function converges to a multiple 1 over square root pi, times the Gaussian free field with Dirichlet boundary conditions. And the fact that Dirichlet boundary conditions occur is partly related to the fact that we have chosen Tempelian boundary conditions. So far, so good. So this is the critical case. This is here we chose all the weights equal to one, and we have a conformal invariant scaling. So yeah, as I said, his result was proved first on the square lattice, and then Beatrice Dottilia extended it to full plane with isoradial superposition, then Zhongyong Li on domains, assuming that these domains have a straight edge portion, and there's some more recent results by myself and Benoît Lallien who are so. So let me tell you some of the recent results that we have for dimers when we consider near-critical perturbation. So the near-critical model was really introduced by Sunil Chitta in 2012, and he introduced it on the square lattice, on the whole plane, for what will correspond to the case. Later, I will have a more general model, and this will turn out to be the case where alpha is constant. And what he showed was, there is still a height function, and there is still a scaling limit of this height function, but in this case, the limit is non-Gaussian. And okay, so let me tell you what is the kind of near-critical perturbation I'm doing. The basic parameter for this deformation will be a vector field. So alpha is going to be a function from the domain onto R2 or the complex plane, depending on how you like to think about it. So vector field, I think of it as an external electromagnetic field. But I'm always going to assume that alpha derives from a certain potential, which I'm going to call V. So here's an illustration. So you can think the domain is a square. And here's your electromagnetic field alpha. And let me tell you how we define associated, once I specify this vector field for you, how do I specify the near-critical dimer model? So I'm just going to change the weights. They're not going to be equal to one. And I'm going to fix any black vertex Z, but a blue black vertex. And around each, I'm going to modify the edge weights around this vertex Z in the following manner. I'm going to take it to be exponential of the difference of the potential along the edge ZW. So I should clarify that have in mind the situation where we have a very small mesh size. So Z and W are really very close to one another. So V of Z and V of W are pretty close to one another. And this weight is pretty close to one because V is continuous. Okay, is that clear? How do I define that? So around every black vertex, which is blue, I will modify the edge weights in this manner, and otherwise the edge weight remains one. So these edge weights, they are unoriented, but I can think also that they define oriented weights on the lattice gamma, on the blue lattice. And if I do a random walk, which is oriented, so I use C of Z and W as the weight going from Z to its blue neighbor in the direction W. And if I do a random walk with this weight, it turns out the walk on this blue lattice would converge to the Langevin diffusion, meaning dx, source dx equals d of a Brownian motion plus a drift given by this gradient field. Oh. So this is, if you want to understand the meaning of these weights, that's what they do. So here's a simulation, which is, I think you can probably tell that I'm cheating. Yes, this is the one simulation due to me. So you imagine that you have this drift, and the drift is kind of pushing your walk towards the boundary. Okay. So, yes, it's going to be very important that the drift derives from a potential for what I'm going to say. Like that plays a crucial role. There will be another assumption that the potential is going to be log convex, This I'm less certain whether it plays a role, but the fact that the drift derives from potential is crucial for what we need to say. And I have no idea what happens if you remove this. I really
do sure.
I don't venture in this.
Yes, there's a question.
Yeah. Also, the DXR solution of the EC model, there is a mapping in the dimer for each 4 points. I mean, you take each point
right.
4 points, and then that is a dimer model with a mass. So why you don't use it?
Okay, the question is there exists exact mapping between dimers and easing
massive.
Exactly. So why don't I just start working with a easing model? This is a very good question, and it has to do with the fact that these mappings don't behave well at all at boundary conditions.
This is the way you have to go. You are prepared to look for patterns, right? To some important patterns. That's what you mean. You don't like to look for patterns.
I'm not sure this.
Okay,
okay, I'm not sure. Was there more questions?
No, there is a paper by Julien Dubeda. They do the paper.
There is a paper by Julien Dubeda, which is called bosonization, I guess, exact bosonization for the Higgs model, something like that, where these kind of relations are described. I don't know whether he specifically discussed the massive case, but probably one can do something in the massive case. But I think it behaves very badly at the boundary. It's kind of exact. Okay, so let me first tell you about the connection to massive SLE for this near critical dimer model. It turns out that, so first of all, I'm going to assume, as I said, my basic parameter to describe the deformation of the dimer model is this vector field alpha. So I'm going to assume that alpha describe, you know, derives from the potential. Every time I specify alpha, I specified for you a near critical dimer model. And I'm going to assume not only that my drift derives from a potential, but this potential is log convex, meaning that Laplacian P plus radian P squared is now negative in omega. And this is an assumption that I'll come back to that in a second. So the theorem, I mean, it's a bit hard to describe here because I don't have that much time. There, it turns out there are paths one can naturally associate it to the dimer model. For those of you who know, there is a bijection called Temporis bijection, which transforms the dimer model into spanning trees. And one can then naturally consider the spanning, the path connecting a point in the interior to the boundary via the spanning tree. And this is what this picture is showing you. And the theorem that we proved with Levi-Hantzmann-Sibbis a couple of years ago, well, a few years ago, is that the scaling limit of this path is Makarov and Smirnov's massive SLE. So I should say that this is what you get when the drift alpha is constant. It's exactly the process considered by Makarov and Smirnov as well as Chak and Perman. And when alpha is not a constant vector field, then the scaling limit is a form of massive SLE2, which is novel. And it turns out that from this it follows that you know, if I consider the associated height function, then this height function has a scaling limit. And we are also able to prove at that time that the limiting height function satisfies a form of conformal covariance. Now, we were also able to conjecture a precise link to the Sandgordon model, and that's what I want to tell you next. Let's have questions. Yes.
The conformal invariant for the massive.
The question is, do I have conformal invariance for the massive? So the fact that it's massive means exactly that I don't have conformal invariance, but I have conformal covariance. The massivity translates.
But then the mass becomes non-uniform.
Yes, exactly. So thank you. The question is, but then the mass does not remain uniform, and that's so thank you, that's a very good point. So for us, it's very important that we're able to work with masses that are variable, and indeed drift vector fields that vary from place to place, because this is what, if you want to play with conformal covariance, you will naturally be led.
And then we use this terminology, any massive field theory will be conformally
Any mass efficient theory would be conformally covariant. Is this theory?
Yeah.
I don't know. I'm not. I don't know.
Yeah, sure. You show the P conform can be vary from point to point.
I don't know enough.
Transformation.
You can just change the. But it sounds like you say that's definitely the case. The comment is that probably in this sense every conform every quantum field theory is conform covariant. Maybe.
Just the trade-off between this bearing mass and the confounded factor, scale factor dimension.
I should move on because otherwise.
You just wait. You wait a complete constant to fill by the conformal factor on
the master. That's tricky.
There is an interesting discussion. I will not repeat all of the discussion. So let me tell you a bit about this connection to Sam Gordon. Again, I'm going to assume that the drift vector field alpha derives from a potential which is the convex. And so, as I said, this assumption is that the Laplacian V plus gradient V squared is non-negative. And this function really plays the role of the mass. It turns out this assumption is conformal. Right? If I map V by conformal map, it turns out it remains the convex in that sense. So the theorem that is novel, you can find it on the archive from maybe a month or two ago, says that, so it proves this conjecture that we had formulated precisely in this previous paper with living function series. And so we're going to assume that the domain contains a straight edge portion, or is the image of such a domain by a map, which is analytic in a neighborhood of omega, so pretty smooth domain. We're going to consider the centered height function associated to the near critical diagonal model defined by alpha, defined by this vector. And the theorem says that as epsilon tends to zero, this height function converges to a certain field in low, in the sense that when I test it against test function, it converges converges low for arbitrary test function. It's one part of the theorem. Furthermore, every time I pick a vector S1 through Sn of zeros and ones, think of them as signs. And every time I consider pairwise disjoint points Z1 through Zn in omega, if I start considering the products of the holomorphic and anti-holomorphic derivatives of the fields at the point Z1 through Zn, so the Si are telling you whether I consider the holomorphic or anti-holomorphic derivatives. So we can compute these correlation functions in weak sense at least. And the theorem says that these derivatives are given by, well, the correlation of the derivatives are given by by a certain determinant of the matrix, where, so as I said, the DSI stands for Bietanger derivatives, so holomorphic or anti-holomorphic. And these F functions, there are certain massive holomorphic functions. I'll say later what that means. And they satisfy a certain boundary condition, which is called square random boundary. You want to know what I mean by, in a weak sense, I mean that this is missing some derivatives. I mean that it's okay. So this is concretely what it means the correlations of the derivatives of the field are given by this determinant in a weak sense. Okay. So it's a certain expression, determinant expression for the correlations of the derivatives of the field. Now,
you would tell us what is F.
The question is, will I tell you what is F? And it depends whether I have time or not. Maybe. If you behave well. Okay, so what about the connection to Sam Gordon? So, I'm going to suppose omega is the unit disk, and alpha, I will have to impose some additional assumptions, which I won't explain now. And the theorem says that in that case, we get a more precise expression for the correlation of the holomorphic and anti-holomorphic derivative in the field. And it's given specifically by a multiple of the same correlation function for what's called the Sam Gordon model. It's a mass profile rho, and rho is related to alpha in some fairly complicated profile. You can read the definition if you want. So I haven't told you what is this expectation for Sam Gordon, and I need to do that now. That's what I'm going to do now. There is a moment problem in the interest of time, I won't tell you. So what is the Sam Gordon model? So informally, I'm going to the Sam Gordon model with profile rho. So I'm going to pick a function from omega to R now. It's a real valued function. And informally, the Sam Gordon law is basically the law of the Gaussian free field. So that's this PGFF sharp here. But it's really reweighted by a certain factor, which is the exponential of a constant times integral over the domain of cosine of square root beta times the field times the max profile rho z. Okay, so one has to pay attention to normalization conventions because they are important here. There are different ways of normalizing the Gaussian free field, corresponding to different way of normalizing the Laplacian or the Green function. And here my convention is that the two-point function of this field is 1 over 2 pi times the log plus a bounded term. Okay. Okay, so now this was an informal definition, and I have to warn you right away that assigning a rigorous meaning to this expression is really far from straightforward. And in fact, as beta increases, so beta was appeared in the definition, the model goes through a sequence of thresholds where the definition of the Sam Gordon becomes increasingly more difficult. And the first such threshold is at beta equals 4 pi, which is known as the free Fermion point. And these are the thresholds they accumulate at beta equals 8 pi in this normalization. Now, for beta less than 4 pi, it turns out one can directly assign meaning to the integral that appeared in the exponential in front of the law of the Gaussian free field, the radon Gaussian derivative. And one has to regularize the field. You know, it doesn't really make sense to take the cosine of the Gaussian free field because the Gaussian free field is not pointwise defined, so the cosine is not directly defined. But I can regularize the field at scale epsilon and consider the cosine of that and renormalize appropriately. So it turns out one has to renormalize by epsilon to the minus beta over 4 pi. As you send epsilon tends to zero, it turns out this limit exists. It's known as imaginary multiplicative chaos. And you can look at the work of Unila, who's here, and the Saxman. So for beta less than 4 pi, one can directly assign a meaning to the Sam Gordon model using this definition that I'm explaining here. That means that the Sam Gordon model associated with beta less than 4 pi is well-defined and it turns out absolutely continuous with respect to the law of the Gaussian free field. Now, at beta equals 4 pi, this integral ceases to make sense as a function of phi. Nevertheless, it turns out still possible to make sense of this law, but then presumably that law is not absolutely continuous with respect to the Gaussian free field. Okay, so I will explain later how to do that rigorously, but so that's not all. Informally, at this free fermion point, the Sam Gordon model has additional symmetries, which are known as Coleman's correspondence. So this Coleman correspondence says that the Sam Gordon model with mass profile rho is equivalent to a field of massive free fermions. So I try to explain what that is. So basically, you should think that in this massive free fermion model, we have at every point z of the domain, we have a vector psi z, which consists of two components, psi 1 of z, psi 2 of z, which are Grassmann variables. So these are what's called Dirac fermions. And in this model, massive free fermion model, so this is something which has formal density given by the exponential of this action, this integral. And S of psi, this action is given in terms of the Dirac operator, in fact, the massive Dirac operator. Okay, so this is the Coleman correspondence. And so as I said, it relates the sine Gordon model to the massive free fermion. Let me take a little bit of time to say what that means. First of all, you should think of this as a massive extension of the boson fermion correspondence. What I mean by that is that if one takes rho equals zero, so that means no deformation, then this correspondence tells you that the reaction free field is equivalent to this free fermion model, where the density, the formal density, would be exponential of minus this integral. So that's a boson fermion correspondence. And one thing that I found really remarkable about this Coleman correspondence is that the sine Gordon model, which is, you know, this sort of fairly complicated object, which has a law that turns out is really quite hard to define on the probabilistic side. Well, when you look at it on this fermionic side, it kind of becomes trivial because you get this expression for the formal density, and this is a quadratic expression, which means you know, it really is a free fermion model. It's as if we were considering the massive Gaussian free field, but for fermions. So it's like it becomes Gaussian, if you like, when you look at it on the fermion side. So it's sort of trivializes the sine Gordon model, which I find quite remarkable. So now, constructing the right-hand side rigorously is something that is relatively standard as far as I understand in mathematical physics. For instance, one can look at this work with Benfato, Falco, and Mastropietro-Sprassky. And this is a particular case of the theorem model, which in general even allows for a quartic interaction, a bit like in the 5-4 model for those of you. Now the Coleman correspondence can also be expressed nicely when it comes to computing correlation functions of the field. So I try to explain that. And to do that, it's very nice to repackage the information contained in this fermionic model using a different kind of a different parametrization regime, which is the following. So we're going to introduce what's called the Majorana fermion. Before, we were dealing with something called Dirac fermions. Personally, I knew nothing about this, and I still, I'm really not an expert in these things. So what that means is we take the Dirac fermion psi 1 and psi 2, and we repackage them differently. So we're going to call psi the sum psi 1 plus I psi 2, and psi star psi 1 minus I psi 2. And together, I think of this as another, you know, it's the same information, but repackaged differently. Psi star. It's the same term. And it turns out when you do that, one way of expressing the correlations of the sine Gordon, of the derivatives of the sine Gordon, is as expectations of these Majorana fermions for the fermionic dimensions. So that means if I look at the correlations of the holomorphic and anti-holomorphic derivatives of the sine Gordon models, they are given by the expectation under this fermionic measure of the product of the psi or psi star, depending on whether Si is 0 or 1 under this measure. And again, you have to understand this in the weak sense. Okay, and this, you know, bracket notation is expectation under this measure. And it turns out, by the way, that this has very concrete expression, this correlation. So, okay, so.
So why on the right hand side not bilinear under fermions? Is that
why is the right hand side not bilinear?
Usually it's a psi psi bar or something.
Yes. I guess maybe this is probably yes. Yeah, sorry. So one can go further because you know, just like for probabilists, you know that if you have a Gaussian random variable, you can compute the nth moment of a Gaussian in terms of these two-point functions. So that's the weak rule. And it turns out there is a similar property for fermionic fields. So I guess it's called the fermionic weak rule. And as a consequence of Coleman's correspondence, it's possible to evaluate endpoint function, well, of the derivatives of the sine Gordon field in terms just of its two-point functions. And this gives exactly the following fact. So the endpoint correlation functions of holomorphic and anti-holomorphic derivatives of the field is the determinant of its two-point function. So the fact that it's a determinant expresses the fermionic nature of the field. So this fermionic Greek rule is very convenient for the identification of the sine order in the scaling limit that we're considering for the dimer model, because it means that it tells us if you want to show something in the sine Gordon field, you have to find determinants for the correlation functions of the derivatives of the hat function. And that's exactly what we got in our first video. Okay, so this was kind of informal so far. Let me tell you what is rigorous. So in the unit disk, if I take omega equals the unit disk, and I fix some smooth function with compact support, a very recent work of Barth, Hiltanen, and Webb, following the earlier work of Baruch, Schmidt, and Webb, the thing, construct the Sine-Gordon model at this free fermion point and rigorously establish the Coleman transform. So more precisely, they start from the white noise regularization of the Gaussian free field. I call that pi epsilon. And you can introduce the weak renormalized cosine of the field. So this is what I indicate with these two dots. And so you take the cosine of the, I guess the square root beta is missing from the right-hand side. So you take the cosine of the regularized field, you normalize it appropriately, as I said. And yes, that's the weak renormalized field. Now, it turns out if you want to see something further for the at the free fermion point, you have to renormalize further. And that's this double dot that you see on this slide here. In the paper, there are two very big dots. I don't know how they do it. So with my software, I couldn't do this. So sorry. So you have to subtract some additional constant, which is explicit and is universal. Whereas C alpha, which really should be zero, but zero should be C alpha, was explicit but not universal. And right, so the expectation of F for the renormalized Sine Gordon model at the renormalization scale epsilon is given exactly by this expression. Okay, so you have to subtract infinity addition, and that's related to the fact that the Sine Gordon at beta equals 4 pi is not absolutely continuous with respect to the Gaussian. And then the theorem of Barth, Virtanen, and Webb is that as epsilon tends to zero, if you look at the derivative of this field, sorry, I'm missing the phi, if you look at the correlations of the derivatives, the holomorphic and anti-holomorphic derivative of this field, then this exists and is given by a determinant. And the determinant of the two-point function, and this two-point function, we understand it quite well. It's particular. It solves a certain explicit boundary value problem, certain explicit boundary condition. Say again. Yes, beta equals 4 pi. Yeah, I should have said. This is beta equals 4 pi, and So if you want, it constructs the Sine-Gordon model associated to this profile rho in the unit disk with beta equals 4 pi and shows the validity of the Coleman transform. Yeah. So how much time do I have?
How much should you need?
I think you're the chair, right?
A bit less than 10 minutes.
A bit less than 10 minutes? Okay. I tried to tell you a little bit about I tried to tell you a little bit about some of our methods and some things related that I think are related to this Sine-Gordon model in general, and which is massive holomorphicity. So the first thing that we have to do is up till now I was kind of thinking of my vector field alpha well as a vector field, but now it turns out it starts to be better to think of it as a complex valued function. And we define massive holomorphicity as the equation that says d bar f is half alpha n bar. So, you know, if alpha equals zero, we find the equation d bar f equals zero, which is the equation for holomorphic. And this generalizes the notion which was introduced earlier by Makarov and Smirnov and had been studied also by Pardon in the constant case where alpha was a constant, a purely imaginary constant. So here's a lemma which is interesting, maybe, which relates some of the notions I've introduced so far, which is that if I take an alpha massive holomorphic function in this sense, then its real part is massive harmonic, meaning massive with respect to the mass, which is exactly this function that I assume to be non-negative for the potential. So, meaning that I compute the Laplacian of the real part of f, and I find that it's mu times this real part, where mu is this mass function. So, the sum of the Laplacian of it.
What's the Dirac equation?
Is this a Dirac equation here?
I think so.
The d bar f equals alpha f bar?
Yeah.
I'm not sure, because for me, the Dirac equation would be for a pair of functions. So,
what pair of functions? I would say very much soft, it's a messy thing.
It could well be that when you apply it to f, So if you take, as I said, so the lemma is that if I take something which is alpha holomorphic, alpha massive holomorphic, then its real part is massive harmonic. I don't say anything about the imaginary part because this plays a different role in the story. We do not know if, conversely, starting from a massive harmonic function, does there exist a function, does it have a harmonic conjugate, basically? Does there exist? Can I turn it by adding an imaginary part? Can I turn it into a massive holomorphic function? We don't know if that's true in general, but fortunately for us, it turned out that will be the case of what we really care about, which is an inverse Castellan matrix that I'm going to talk about now. Okay, so a bit of Castellan theory. So, as I said, the Sandgordon model is not conformal, but it is integrable. And for us, I think part of the integrability comes from the fact that the dimer model itself is something that has a lot of structure, and this structure comes from Castellan theory. So basically, by the definition of the height function, I know I didn't believe the definition of the height function, but you have to trust me on that. The discrete derivatives of the height function corresponds precisely to whether an edge is occupied by a dimer. And so if you want to understand the correlation of the derivative of the height function, then you have to understand dimer-dimer correlations. Now, Castellan theory is exactly what is telling you what you need in order to compute this dimer-dimer correlations. And it's telling you that the probability that you see a particular set of edges appearing in your random matching is given, well, actually, there is a constant which tends to one, not rightly, is given basically by a determinant of the inverse of this celebrated matrix, the Castellan matrix, which you can think of as being a signed adjacency matrix of the graph, the inverse versus space. Okay, so the key is really to show the convergence of this inverse Castellan matrix to a pair of complex functions. And the point is that if you pick your black vertex B to be on the blue lattice, then you will get a certain limit. Whereas if you take it to be in the red cell lattice, you will get a different limit. So the limit of the inverse Castellan matrix kind of depends on the combinatorial type of the black vertex. And in my mind, this corresponds really to the fact that at any point in the continuum, you have two Dirac fermions, the psi one and the psi two. So this sort of kind of funny combinatorial construction where you impose this Tempelian structure for the domain, which separates the two types of black vertices into two, you kind of see it reflected in the fact that naturally for the Sandgordon model, there are two types of fermions, the psi one and the psi two. Right, so as I said, the key is to say something about the scaling limit for the inverse Gaussian matrix. And what we show really is that, yes, I'm just basically saying what I've just said now, that there is a scaling limit for this inverse Gaussian matrix. And that limit depends on whether you're talking about a black vertex of type blue or of type red. So let me tell you a little bit, a few things about how one proves that. First of all, it's not hard to see that when you consider a black vertex, which is a blue vertex, then K inverse is a discrete derivative of the massive green function. So using tools from discrete complex analysis, which are extended to the massive setting, this gives a scaling limit for K inverse in this situation. So it's more complicated to analyze the case where the black vertex is basically a red vertex. So when alpha equals to zero, you say K inverse is the identity. And basically one way to interpret this is to say that K inverse is a discrete holomorphic function. So you kind of read this identity to say, well, the derivatives in Y are exactly I times the derivative in the X direction. And so when you integrate these derivatives together with the earlier asymptotics for the case where X was a blue vertex, this allows you to derive a conclusion that the inverse Gaussian matrix has a scaling limit, whether or not you were considering a blue vertex or a red vertex. Now, in the massive setting, this is not so simple, unfortunately. So basically, this argument here that I've just sketched was essentially Rick Kenyon's original argument for his proof of conformal invariance of the diamond model. Now, in this massive setting, this is not so simple, unfortunately. But basically, in the continuum, what you can say is that if you have a function which is u plus iv, and it's massive holomorphic, then you can rephrase that in terms of basically a version of the Cauchy-Riemann equation, which relates the gradients of u and the gradients of v by rotation, but you have to conjugate by the potential. So that's in the continuum, but what is key to our work is that you find an exact discrete form of this identity, which is satisfied by K inverse. And okay, so that means that essentially, once you understand this identity at the discrete level, you can use asymptotic for K inverse restricted to blue vertices and transform it to asymptotic for K inverse on red vertices. That's kind of the idea of the national. All right, so thank you here. And I'm just going to advertise that there's a program at the Schrödinger Institute in Vienna this fall. This is more about connections between probability and combinatorics, but if you're interested, please let me know. Once again, thanks for your knowledge.
Thank you. Questions? Let you do my question.
You skipped over the Molden problem slide, but is that a good case for the Molden problem to determine?
Yes, it turns out, thank you. So it turns out we can really solve the Molden problem, meaning that these moments really do determine the distribution uniquely, and we find an interesting formula. There is an interesting formula, where is this? Oh, someone, sorry, I'm not going to look for it. There's an interesting Fredholm regularized determinant formula for the moments, basically. So that says that the distribution really is determined by the moments, because in fact, it's determined by its cumulants. That's what I should say. But the moments determine the cumulants. So.
Let's just make a point that if you have the waveform for bad,
yes,
you are really getting more evolution, you have a quantity dense.
Yes.
So you change something. Well, that appears like a black one.
Right.
The polynomial equivalency particularly helpful in the opposite way, synthesis of maps and interact in theory in a free one.
Right.
Usually, that's what the original condition. Just to make sure that around 4 pi, we're not called healing without interaction.
Right.
Free
right.
Here,
exactly.
You have a question?
tracing model is very difficult, but also very difficult.
Yes.
And your magic is the password,
That's a good question. I think from the donations to this means, yeah, that's like a very interesting program. And I should say that, the paper of Bart Bertrand and Manuel, they really specifically relate the Sam Gordon model to limits of temperature that we see model. Probably is an expression of this exact bosonization. But as I said, the exact bosonization, that's the one at least that I know of, which comes from this paper of Duveda that was alluded to earlier, behaves very badly at the boundary. So I don't know what extent, certainly philosophically that's right. Technically, I'm not sure. And I haven't thought at all about trying to go into the last one with the founding.
It's not the same as EZ. It's not the free fermion away from. I mean, it's like a six vertex one with the mass.
You should speak with the microphone.
There is one last question.
Yes.
I'm very sorry if I may come in. So, in fact, in this paper by Julian, which is like 15 years old, there is a correspondence which says, up to the boundary. This is the American Green Plus of the maze, which I know paper that.
Exactly, it's not incoming.
But by a different one, is a plus of the paper. And all the correlation identity, they call them.
Yes, but I think from the Danger side, it's a. The kind of boundary conditions that you end up with, they are very much more size.
They end up with boundary conditions.
Very good. Thank you very much for your talk.
We are then for the next.